Hello, the Internet. My name is Matt Welch. I am the editor-in-chief of Reason, the magazine of free minds and free markets. I'm also the author of McCain, The Myth of a Maverick. I am delighted to be joined today by the New Republic's Noam Scheiber. He's a senior editor and a campaign writer extraordinaire who has most recently and most notoriously stomped around the frozen tundra of Alaska to find out the real Sarah Palin. Noam, how the hell are you?
I'm well. Good to be here with you.
Tell us why we should care that Sarah Palin didn't graduate from Harvard.
I guess it shouldn't make much of a difference at all, other than the fact that she does seem to have some both status and social insecurities, as well as intellectual insecurities. And she tends to lash out at those people who she perceives to be either her social betters or her intellectual betters. And it can be kind of a combustible attribute, I guess, because she often perceives intellectual and social condescension even where it doesn't exist, which I guess is a real problem. Perfectly normal, I would say, to react badly when someone actually is being condescending, but a little dangerous when someone perceives condescension when it doesn't exist and responds very, very harshly to it. So I think that's the problem. And
is there an example of her responding in a way that sort of impacts or has impacted her role as a government official, for example?
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous examples. Some of them aren't to her discredit. But the earliest example that actually gets highlighted in this hagiography that was written by a friend of hers, I guess, Kayleen Johnson, which is the biography that was widely distributed immediately after she was put on the ticket. The example that the biographer put describes in the book is an early conflict she had with a fellow city councilman, a guy by the name of Nick Carney. And Nick Carney owned a garbage removal service in Wasilla. And Palin and Nick Carney sort of split because in her mind, Nick Carney was trying to abuse his power as a city councilman to try to win a contract for his company with the city, and she thought that this was completely unethical and just an example of the, you know, good old boys network in action. As it happens, there was no insider deal here. Nick Carney had actually recused himself from deliberations over awarding a contract to a garbage removal service. He was brought in to testify as sort of an expert witness. And during this testimony, and just generally, Nick Carney would sort of remind Sarah Palin, I guess, in not so subtle ways, that that she didn't know what she was talking about, which happened. There were many examples of this while she was on the city council. So she would always react sort of violently to this. And the thing about Nick Carney, to keep in mind, is that Nick Carney was one of the very few people from Wasilla to go to an Ivy League school. He was an incredibly well-read guy, very worldly, at least, you know, by the standards of where he grew up and when he grew up, and just was a sort of formidable intellectual force. So it wasn't so much that that he was condescending to her intentionally, but just by virtue of really knowing his stuff, and pointing out, you know, mistakes in logic and mistakes in fact, you know, he would sort of expose her to be kind of the bullshitter. Can we say bullshitter on Blogging Heads?
Let's find out.
Exposing her to be...
I heard Bolshevik.
Okay. Expose her to be a little empty in some of her critiques of him and just in some of her positions generally on the city council. And fellow city councilors, the former mayor, John Stein, have all told me that she would often sort of react pretty negatively to discussions with Carney, largely because he was just sort of an unrelenting, intensely logical person, and she felt that she was made insecure by him.
But I mean, yeah, I've got no problem on some level with someone feeling either insecurity or acting like a semi-jerk in being in scrutinizing city contracts or whatever. Did this ever like translate into what you could describe as, you know, worse government action than merely asking some silly questions at a hearing at a city council?
Yeah, well, so Nick Carney and Palin were sort of tangled quite a bit thereafter, and oftentimes it seemed that Palin's actions, particularly as mayor, once she became mayor, were designed to kind of settle some score with Nick Carney. So, for example, shortly after she became mayor, there were two vacant seats on the city council. One was the one that she vacated to become mayor, and then another person had run for another office in the area, I think like a county or borough office, as they call it there. So there were two vacant seats that had to be filled. The normal procedure for filling them was, I think, some kind of consensus by the council. But Palin decided that she sort of wanted to do it her own way, which was basically to pack the council with two people who would be sympathetic to her. And in her quote about this to the local paper there, the Frontiersman, she explained the rationale in basically those terms, and then said, or the paper, I guess, paraphrased her as saying, the look on Nick Carney's face told her that she had succeeded, which is to say, by thwarting his efforts to do this through the normal channels and instead doing it in a way that packed the city council with her allies, she accomplished her goal of basically frustrating and humiliating Nick Carney, which seems like a not the greatest approach to running a city.
Now, imagine this on the scale of a vice president. Certainly, she's not the only person running for vice president who has curious personality defects.
Sure.
How would you imagine this playing out on a stage that matters to us?
Yeah, I think, suffice it to say, I don't think these personality quirks scale well. If you can imagine her using the apparatus of the Wasilla mayor's office to lash out at people that she had perceived to condescend to her intellectually, well, the vice president's, the apparatus of the vice president's office is obviously somewhat more powerful than that of the Wasilla mayor's office, and the number of people who could potentially condescend to her in her, dealings as vice president is probably multiplied a thousandfold. I don't think it's a great combination.
Let's remember that since the Wasilla episode, she's undergone about 2 months of the most intense nationwide condescension of any public figure.
Absolutely.
In a really long time. I recall my friend Anna Marie Cox being on the Rachel Maddow show, mm-hmm. and both, basically agreeing, like, well, of course, someone with an accent like that. I mean, come on.
Right.
I think that there's been elements of, I mean, there's certainly more than one argument against Palin, and argument for Palin's nomination to be, a pretty good data point for why McCain is not as strong a candidate as some people were assuming that he would be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've also seen a lot of kind of outpouring of not the prettiest amount of thought and direction her way. It's very interesting. I mean, people who are somehow appalled by her academic record, like, oh, my God, she went to five different schools in 6 years, as if that matters to anyone, certainly me.
Sure.
And so after, another 2 months of intense national caricature, whatever sense of grievance that she has along these lines would certainly be multiplied, I'm sure, in some way.
Yeah, no, I think, if it were a kind of a small portion of, a quirk of her personality going in, it's certainly been magnified since then. And I would just add there that I don't, I mentioned this briefly in the piece. This has not always worked out terribly. I mean, I think it would work out badly if she were to become vice president, but her claim to fame, which is sort of rooting out corruption on the oil and gas commission in Alaska was probably partially a function of this quirk of hers, this chip on her shoulder. She sort of clashed with a fellow commissioner named Randy Riedrich, who was pretty condescending, pretty dismissive. He was an engineer, a PhD by training, and he tended to make her feel very insecure because of her lack of technical skill and technical expertise in the oil and gas area. And my sense is that, and from talking to some people who served with her on the commission and who worked for the commission, that you know that she thought this guy was behaving inappropriately to her and somewhat arrogantly and dismissively, and it turned out he was not just doing that to her. He was doing that to, you know, in essence, the people of Alaska by having sort of insider dealings with the very companies that he was supposed to be regulating. So if that helped motivate her desire to kind of clean up what was going on at the Oil and Gas Commission in Alaska, then, you know, more power to her. I guess the concern is this stuff can be kind of arbitrary, and you can never tell when the vendetta is going to be justified and when it's not going to be justified, which is the scary part of it.
Right. I mean, I obviously have written a book that's pretty critical about John McCain, mm-hmm. and gets inside of his skull a little bit, talk about how his personality quirks affect his decision-making process, sometimes negatively, but in many ways, in a number of circumstances, they have impacted things positively. I mean, he's notoriously sort of impatient and short-tempered, and at the same time, you know, if that's going to make him use the F word against a senator on the Senate floor, I certainly don't really have much of a problem with that. And he's used that impatience, even if sometimes it's been ugly around the edges, to do things like restore full diplomatic relations with Vietnam,
right.
which is something that few Republicans would have ever thought of doing, and of like his sense of where he always personalizes things and makes it a question of honor. You know, you don't disagree with me, you're dishonorable. You are putting
right.
your
right.
ambitions ahead of that of the country. He has used that kind of go-to framing to great effect on for taxpayers. I mean, what he did simply in rooting out corruption on the Boeing deal,
yep.
you know, he deserves as much credit as anyone out there for that. And he definitely, you know, attacked his own interest, as Palin did too, on their side of the aisle, going after corruptions in the Jack Abramoff scandal, for
yep.
example, and some other areas. I think that unfortunately that those personality aspects are wed to other philosophical things and quirks that ends up with policy being sort of both bad and kind of incoherent and
right.
Sort of running around with a chicken with a head cut off. But, like, you know, on some level, and one of the reasons why I was interested in McCain in the first place, at least he has a personality.
Right.
I mean, I was drawn to his books because they're interesting to read. I haven't read Obama's books. I assume that you have. And people say something similar. It's rare to find a politician with an interesting pulse, ultimately. I wanted to ask you about that. You wrote a story, I think, back in the spring about Obama's advisors. I think the general thrust of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that he sort of has a surprising kind of list of perhaps centrist or
mm-hmm.
at least kind of a politically Catholic
mm-hmm.
People around him, and that suggests that maybe he'll be a little bit different than one might expect. Talk about that a little bit, because I don't see any evidence as an outsider, someone who hasn't followed too closely, that Obama is anything but, for instance, you know, significantly to the economic left of any Democrat running for president in 16 years. Do you have a different take, having talked to and seen his interaction with his advisors?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say a couple of things. One is, I think Obama is in some respects a product of the moment, and you know, we could quibble about how far to the left he is relative to, say, Bill Clinton in 92, but, you know, I think you have to provide some context, and the context is the whole Democratic Party is to the left of where you know, certainly Bill Clinton was taking it in 92. I mean, even Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, who were, you know, at the forefront of the neoliberal vanguard in the Clinton administration, are to the left of where they were in the 90s. So, you know, it, to some extent, it's not entirely fair to pick Obama out and say, oh, well, look how far we've come since, you know, the early heady days of the Clinton administration.
Look, I mean, at this point, the guy's going to be the president, so it's entirely fair to poke him with a fork.
No. Sure, the guy should be scrutinized, you know, from head to toe. My point is just you have to understand the context in which he's operating, and the context is, you know, the Bush years were caused a lot of hand-wringing and deep thinking and rethinking among even people like Rubin and Summers, who, you know, Gene Sperling, who were closely associated with the Clinton sort of neoliberal agenda, and problems that they thought, you know, the agenda could sort of solve and that it seemed to be solving in the 90s, like income inequality, poverty even. Suddenly the trends started reversing themselves in the Bush era, even though, you know, on certain principles, Bush actually wasn't that far, or Bush claimed not to be that far from where, you know, from where Clinton was, you know, trade, for example. So the point is just that a lot of smart people, you know, in the Democratic Party aren't where they were in the 90s. Obama may well have been closer to those people in the 90s and remain close to them, but they've shifted as well.
What about the neoliberal New Republic, right?
So right, no, that's right.
The House organ for
that's right.
Quasi-sensible economics.
The New Republic has certainly moved a bit left on some of these questions. I think there's no doubt about that. You know, just on the question of of trade, of outsourcing, there's been you know, some, you know, gnashing of teeth in our hallways, as there has been, you know, throughout the Democratic Party, or at least on, you know, the people who once had different views. Just on the question of Obama's advisors, I do think, you know, by sensibility and by disposition, this is a guy who is empirically minded. It's a guy who kind of has a fetish for experts. I remember having a conversation with one of his aides while I was writing the piece, and this person was telling me, you know, it's almost the opposite of Sarah Palin. He wants the absolute foremost expert in the world on whatever narrow topic he happens to be talking about. And so he would sort of insist to them that unless, you know, they had the top two or three, you know, academic experts on this particular, you know, area of you know, microeconomics, he didn't want to have that conversation. So I do think, in a way, just by disposition, it ensures a certain amount of engagement on the issues on a level that if you were strictly sort of an ideological person, you wouldn't do. So, you know, it just may be that the foremost experts on, you know, pension, you know, designing pension and you know, 401ks, is, you know, not, you know, slightly to the left or slightly to the right of center. For Obama, my sense is that he wants that person who's the world's foremost expert on pension contributions. So I think that whatever his ideological impulses might be, they're checked a bit by that other impulse, which is just to deal with people who, you know, in which the expertise resides. And I think you see that, you know, Austin Goolsbee was a guy who, prominent economist at the University of Chicago, was a guy who Obama got to know personally in the 2004 race for Senate. He kind of stayed in Obama's orbit while he was in the Senate, and then, you know, for a while was kind of the top economic advisor to the campaign, and the various reasons why he receded from the landscape, though he appears to be sort of back in the fold. But the bottom line is, Austin Goolsbee is not what you would call a sort of paleoliberal by any stretch. It's a guy who very much believes in markets. I mean, has a slight leftward tilt politically, I think, but very much in the sort of you know, somewhere between the neoclassical and the neo-Keynesian tradition in academic economics, which is very much you know, having a faith in markets. And Obama and Goolsbee, you know, really did bat a lot of this stuff back and around. And you know, Obama engages on the level of design, of you know, institutions, of how you get the best results, you know, how you get people to, you know, how a tax system works efficiently, that sort of thing, and not on the level of ideology. So I think part of it is just disposition more than anything else.
A couple things on that. One, I talked to a couple of people who have dealt with Obama from sort of the Republican side of the aisle, or the free market side of the aisle, which, needless to say, doesn't have much to do with Republicans anymore. And they say that, you know, like Bill Clinton, he is a great listener, and he makes you feel like you're the smartest and most important person in the room, and you walk away just sort of impressed with his equanimity. I don't know what that word means, by the way, and his just sort of sense of calm and listening and seeking experts, and then he's going to go out and vote right against you immediately thereafter. But you feel like you were special for 30 minutes, and that's kind of that plus, you know, a Democratic Congress and a campaign that has been run, you know, against free trade every single day. That to me is not an insignificant issue when you're talking about the best way for poor people to get unpoor, and running against that as the world's kind of leading market economy is incredibly worrisome to me. I mean, he brought that up in his, you know, his first great sort of a Reverend Wright race speech. He was talking about, like, well, you know, black, white, whatever, we're all united in that, you know, the dirty Chinaman's taking your job, you know. I mean, he has invoked a sort of Sinophobia that I really haven't seen coming from the left since, just coming in general since, like, the Japan nuttiness of the late 80s and early 90s. My God, they're going to buy Rockefeller Center. What's America coming to? All that stuff I'm really worried about in a tangible way. I think that we have to look at what people actually say on a daily basis in the campaign. And it's pretty clear that, you know, he wants to set industrial policy out of Washington. He's going to, with his...
What's the evidence for his desire to set industrial policy out of Washington?
We're going to create 5 million new green jobs, you know, through our investments, which is always, you know, French for taxation. I mean, that is, we are going to, as a government, start the next Silicon Valley, which is just kind of a remarkable sentiment, if you think about it, as if Silicon Valley would have happened if it was a government experiment. These kind of notions are out there on a daily basis. They made sure to hit those themes every single speech at the Democratic Convention. The phrase 5 million green jobs was in there every single time. So I'm worried, about a lot of things, not least of which is that now we're apparently nationalizing our banks willy-nilly. And with a Democratic Congress and a unified Democratic front and things like card check coming down the pike, which I think is just gratuitously awful, I am not, for one, looking forward to our new Democratic overlords. Not that the Republicans don't deserve to lose in many respects, but unified government frightens me. And even if a guy listens and gets all the experts, which is to say experts are almost always overrated. Henry Paulson is an expert about what's good for Goldman Sachs, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's been coming up with great ideas for how to deal with the liquidity crisis. So I have a lot of sort of reasons to worry, neck of the ideological spectrum, it's a lot of libertarians flirting with the idea of voting for Obama, and a lot of conservatives we've all seen in the last couple of weeks. And it's so much of it is based on a kind of wishful thinking. Like, I heard Austin Goolsbee give a good speech in Canada once.
Right.
That is, slightly different than the speech that Obama gives every day on the campaign trail. So I don't see a sort of a reason for hope-tasticness.
Right. Well, I guess I'd say a couple of things. I mean, look, you know, Bill Clinton talked about, you know, as you alluded to, about the nasty Chinese and the butchers in Beijing and how, you know, George H.W. Bush had coddled them. And then once he got into office, you know, actually did a lot of business with the Chinese and liberalized trade quite dramatically. So I think you have to account somewhat for atmospherics and for scoring cheap political points in a campaign. It's not always the most ennobling or enlightening process. And I agree that people should be held responsible for what they say on the campaign. You should definitely not give them a pass. But I don't think the correspondence between what they say on that campaign and what they do in office is always one-to-one. And I think the correspondence is probably the least when it comes to an emotional issue like trade with China, for example. I mean, our relationship with the Chinese is just so complicated and potentially fraught that it would be very hard to sort of wholesale rethink it, you know, overnight or really over any period of time, you know, any short period of time were Obama to win. I you know, there's a book by Jim Mann, you know, foreign policy writer who wrote Rise of the Vulcans. The book before that he had written was called About Face. It was basically about how, regardless of what position, you know, a candidate takes on China, how tough a line they take, once they get into office, they tend to do business with the Chinese. They're just too big a market to ignore, and they have too much leverage.
I mean, there's a curse of responsibility that you see, and I think you'll see in the next administration on a number of fronts. I mean, I see it now with what happens on the eighth year of, you know, Republicans running the White House is that suddenly Hugh Hewitt is badgering me to support the bailout of, you know, the nationalization of the banking sector. Just try to imagine that conversation taking place with Bill Clinton as president in 1999. It'd be hard to imagine. And that happens also on foreign policy.
Absolutely.
I mean, Obama actually has not been very anti-interventionist in this campaign. Just let's get our boys out of Iraq. And I think once he's, you know, is burdened with and blessed with the responsibility of power, he's going to look around and say, oh my God, you know, I'm reading these daily briefings and the world seems like a scary place, and by gum, we're going to need some drones dropping bombs over Pakistan. I think a lot of people who vote for Obama based on anti-war sentiment are going to be pretty sorely disappointed for exactly that sort of about-face reason.
Yeah, no, and I think that's right, though. I think, I mean, it's something we talk about here a lot, that Bush in some respects has done Obama a favor on Iraq by basically not lowering troop levels that much. So Obama can basically, you know, take the situation that he inherits and more or less preserve the status quo for a while, but make some sort of token reductions that Bush himself probably could have done without dramatically altering the facts on the ground in Iraq, but has essentially, you know, passed down to his successor to do. So I think he'll have a little bit of wiggle room. I agree with you. He's not gonna be able to postpone the day of reckoning indefinitely, and it's gonna come. but I think, you know, maybe he gets a year or so before that day of reckoning comes.
Tell me what the New Republic is rubbing their hands at with glee at the prospect of a unified Democratic Washington, if anything.
Well, look, I mean, the magazine actually has in recent years been very much a proponent of universal health care. So that, you know, it's Obama has said repeatedly it's his priority. We hope that it's one of the priorities he enacts. I mean, the question seems to be more the politics of it, you know, and almost the ordering of priorities. You know, a lot of people argued in the early portion of the Clinton administration that you should have done welfare reform first because it had a broader political appeal, and then built some momentum to healthcare reform. Yeah, you know, it's unclear whether Obama will want to, you know, follow that model or learn from the Clinton mistake and try to do something that's a little more broadly popular before tackling healthcare reform. Having said that, you know, the political appetite for healthcare reform is pretty high, I think. I mean, you have even a lot of, you know, CEOs of large Fortune 500 companies who are very much keen to have some sort of grand bargain on healthcare. So it's not clear that you'll quite get the opposition that you might have gotten, you know, even 15 years ago, 16 years ago. But as sort of policy priorities go, I think that's probably the big one for us.
Are there any fears? Is there something that you're worried that? I mean, the New Republic has always, you know, obviously been in a interesting position, generally more hawkish than your fellow magazines of the left, scrambled a little bit about the Iraq war. I don't know where you guys have ended up these days, but are there things that you're actively worried about?
No, I think you put your finger on it. Iraq, I mean, there's certainly the consensus on the magazine in, you know, shortly after the war started was that it was a mistake, and a mistake to have supported it. Many of us, I can't speak for all my colleagues, many of us came to the conclusion that it was a mistake to go in. But that said, I think a lot of us, myself included, think that there's undeniably been some progress in Iraq in the last, you know, 9 months to a year, and that it would be a shame to, you know, pull the plug prematurely if you could still salvage some sort of stable, you know, semi-democratic Iraqi regime out of it. So I guess the concern would be that Obama starts immediately getting hammered on the left, and the pressure to withdraw abruptly and precipitously becomes sort of overwhelming and very difficult for him to resist. As I said, my sense is that Bush has actually bought him a little time, and that, you know, he'll be able to stall a bit before he's got to do some, you know, make some real tough decisions. But I could easily see, you know, the sort of out of Iraq caucus on the Hill, particularly in the House, being pretty noisy pretty quickly and causing him some headaches at the very least.
I think that regardless of Iraq, which is not something to just throw aside, but that the ongoing financial crisis, which is going to get worse on the macroeconomic level in the next quarter, at least maybe two, maybe 20, but most likely the next one or two, we're going to see finally a recession, which we actually hadn't been in, even though everyone tries to tell us that we are. And that is going to dominate things. And again, that's part of my generalized sense of both worry and just kind of opposition at this point. Because, you know, we're already seeing the automakers coming in and saying, hey, look, you know, we've got these huge pensions.
Right.
We need to unwind those. It's very, you know, if you want us to help you create those 5 million green jobs, maybe you can get some of our toxic debt, too. And the airlines will be the next ones in the line. And, you know, we're at a state now where we this broad acceptance among at least the political and journalistic elite, although not at all, as far as I could tell, by the public, that it is intolerable to accept declining housing prices somehow, that represents market failure if they decline too steeply. And so we just need to, you know, extend ever more guarantees to every financial instrument in the entire universe that's related to a house. And I think Obama's going to be getting a lot of pressure from a lot of different people to, well, you know, back me up too, deal with my toxic problem as well. And I think that we're staring down the face of the mother of all moral hazards at this point. You know, we've got to let something fail here. It's a it's a crisis that was brought on in many ways because credit became too easy, and we're responding by easing credit much more, and you know, telling everyone that don't worry, it's not going to go wrong because we're putting the government's guarantee behind it, which is very much what you know caused seriously much of the problem in the first place. So the impacts that can have, the knock-on impacts, and the different people knocking on the door of Washington and rattling the tin cup, I think is going to dominate the discourse, especially when you see, I mean, we're going to the fourth quarter results are going to be, you know, -3, -4%, or it's going to be something large and ugly, and unemployment's going to get up to 7 or 8% perhaps. And in that context, and after this election, you know, at this, there's going to be so much pressure to put sort of political constraints on anywhere where there's a huge collection of money. I mean, George Will actually had a pretty good column today, I think, or yesterday, talking about the pressure being put by Democrats on the endowments of major universities. Like, you should spend 5% of that money. Well, you know, it's really not your money, Chris Dodd. And you see that in pension funds in California. You see that anywhere, you know, you see that in large philanthropical ventures. There was a case that almost passed in California where basically every nonprofit of a certain size would have to prove that they weren't, you know, that they had enough sort of women, minorities, and were nice to gay people. And I, you know, want to be as nice to gay people as possible. But at some point, you know, the government can't just go off and with a huge club against every large pocket of money in the universe. And I think the wind is at the sails of that type of behavior. And that's something that we're just gearing up to be fighting for the next 4 years.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple of things. I mean, one, the guy does, you know, assuming he wins, have to run for re-election in 4 years. And again, I think the Bill Clinton model is instructive. I mean, you know, the reason that he lost a lot of House seats, the Democrats lost a lot of House seats in 94, is way overdetermined. but I think the bottom line is there was a sense that that he kind of had drifted leftward and kind of led the Democratic Congress run roughshod over him in some respects. And, you know, whether it's the assault weapons ban or health care reform or even the tax package, which I think was the absolute responsible thing to do, but on the campaign trail you could argue that, you know, Bill Clinton raised your taxes. You know, whatever it was, I mean, I think there was a lesson that was learned there for the next Democratic president, which is you have to look out for yourself and to some extent put some distance between yourself and, you know, the Mandarins on the Hill who are going to take the opportunity to enact all of their longstanding, you know, wishes. So I think the historical example looms pretty large, and what the Obama people have demonstrated, you know, in the campaign thus far, you know, if not in, you know, in the process of governing, which he hasn't done yet, is that they are exquisitely attuned to how you get elected and to political imperatives. So I suspect he will have a fairly sophisticated political brain trust around him that, not for reasons of even ideology and centrism, but just pure, crass, pragmatic politics, will act as a bit of a check on, you know, his ability and Congress's ability and all the special pleaders' ability to enact, you know, all the goodies that they dream up. Second thing I would say is, you know, I mean, you do have to prioritize on some level, right? And, you know, if a big energy reform is high on your priority list and a big healthcare reform is, and, you know, you're trying to save the banking system at the same time, you know, it does tend to crowd out some other things, which is not to say that, you know, members of Congress can't attach, you know, earmarks that they've been cooking up for years onto big pieces of legislation that are almost too big to fail. But it is to say that, you know, I suspect you're not going to suddenly start seeing all sorts of new initiatives being cooked up, you know, kind of from whole cloth, and suddenly, you know, paraded through Congress. I mean, I think you'll get some kind of fiscal stimulus that will extend unemployment benefits, send some money to some states. I think the sort of macroeconomic argument for a fiscal stimulus is fairly strong. I mean, you have to accept the sort of parameters of, you know, contemporary management of the economy, which you probably reject, but you know, within the context of the sort of broad consensus of how you manage recessions and deal with recessions, you know, it's going to be perfectly within the sort of mainstream response to have some sort of stimulus package of $100 billion, $200 billion. The one thing you said that I think is very interesting, and maybe this segues us into the next portion of the conversation, is this moral hazard issue, which I agree with you. I think looms very large. You know, the one place I would quibble with what you said is, you know, Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail.
That's the one example.
So, and the
that is the one example. The consensus is among, you know, people who like to make consensus,
sure,
which is to say not me, that Lehman Brothers was, like, you know, an intolerable disaster.
So that's the thing. I mean, I think it is very difficult to let a company fail as a kind of example when it is so intimately connected to the rest of the financial system that it, you know, proceeds to spark a meltdown in the financial markets. And someone I spoke to this week, a Wall Street financier, put it to me well, I think, when he said, you know, look, Lehman Brothers, everyone talks about how, you know, okay, even if it was a mistake to let it fail, at least it had these positive moral hazard implications, and that people will realize that companies can and will be allowed to fail, and that the government won't always be there to bail them out. But actually, it may actually accomplish the reverse, in that everyone realizes that it was an absolute disaster to allow Lehman to fail, and no one, no government official, no regulator will ever want to be tarred with the word Lehman again, and will never allow anyone else to fail from hereafter. So Lehman may have accomplished the reverse of kind of reining in the moral hazard problem.
That's an interesting a bit of gymnastics and kind of funny. I mean, it's there's in the world of people who believe that private markets work better than regulated markets or government-owned markets. One of the great examples is the sort of deregulation, and I just used air quotes, mm-hmm. of the utilities industry, electricity industry in California, which actually was like half deregulated,
right.
But whole parts of it, there was no ability to set prices or let the market set prices. Mm-hmm. And when that blew up, you basically stopped the process of sensible deregulation of utilities in this country, which is, among other things, one of the reasons why, the electricity grid ends up polluting so much and is incredibly inefficient and does all kinds of things that most left-of-center types would find normally objectionable. But partial point being, bad deregulation can hurt, or bad moral hazard can hurt. But I mean, I just disagree with the premise that anything is too big to fail. First of all, I think people talk themselves up into, or talk the sort of finance industry up to be something so complicated, as if it runs on magic and voodoo. Mm-hmm. And when it's like that, then you can convince yourself of any number of things. And certainly there are people on Wall Street who definitely have convinced themselves of any number of things. Henry Paulson was the CEO of Goldman Sachs from 1999 to 2006. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge surprise to me that someone who is one of the five major investment banks in this country would see an intolerable crisis when a lot of pressure is put to bear on mm-hmm. investment banks, it mm-hmm. turns out. And there's this weird cult of the Wall Street financier, whether it's Paulson, whether it's Robert Rubin, whether it's Warren Buffett. Mm-hmm. Because this person got rich, mm-hmm. then they understand how the magic works, mm-hmm. and we should listen to, what they say. And, we wouldn't have that same approach towards Lee Iacocca being in a position in government to deal with the auto industry. I don't think, or I hope. I mean, at some point there would be a recognition of, hey, look, maybe his lens is actually distorted because he sees the world as a major investment banker does, as opposed to someone who might look at a more broad sense of the economy.
So I was not the CEO of Goldman Sachs
right.
between 1999 and 2006,
as far as we know, nor
was I ever the CEO of Goldman Sachs. But I, too, thought that Lehman Brothers was too big to fail. And the reason I thought that is that, basically the fallout that we saw. I mean, Lehman owned a lot of bonds. The bonds defaulted, which drove the price of credit default swaps through the roof. Which are basically like bond insurance. And then all the companies that were selling this suddenly had to pony up a lot of reserves to support this insurance that they were selling, which blew a hole in their balance sheet, like AIG, the big insurer that was bailed out. On top of which, because all of Lehman's bonds defaulted, a lot of money markets, which are basically where a lot of conservative, savers put their money, the money markets were in turmoil, and there were, all sorts of problems in the money markets. In the end result of all of this was to just completely seize up the credit markets. I mean, banks weren't lending to one another.
But they were never completely seized up.
They were pretty seized up.
They were pretty seized up. But what is seized up? What seized up is
seized
that
up is,
no one is... No, I mean, I'm asking a rhetorical question, and I don't want you to talk. No, it means that people are not willing to buy at the price that you are currently willing to sell.
Right.
I mean, markets are about price discovery. And part of bankruptcy and part of selling off assets and seeing what happens is the discovery of prices, because through the proceedings of Lehman Brothers, and when people buy off little chunks and they sell out, we would have, and we should have, started to find out what is the actual price of mortgage-backed securities and credit default swaps.
Right.
But instead, because there was a severe tightening, although LIBOR never went more than 5 percentage points above the basis rate.
That's enormous. I mean, that's almost historically unprecedented.
I lived through the 1980s and 1970s. I mean, it has been a lot worse. Because of that, and then the government came in, and once you know that the 900-pound gorilla is going to come in and start buying up toxic debt, buying up precisely the things that right now we don't know what the prices are, of course no one's going to buy and sell. Why would you? You're going to wait until the government pays a premium on these things that haven't yet found a price discovery. And
right,
another part of that is just the fact that, you know, these things had to be accounted at zero, even though they aren't worth zero, which was part of regulation, not part of deregulation. And that could have been addressed at the time very swiftly by changing that rule, by saying, okay, instead of having this mark-to-market thing where you have to value this piece of paper at precisely zero,
right,
if that moment you can't sell it, you know, do a five-year rolling average, come up with some other sort of valuation that acknowledges that these things are tied to assets that have value.
Right.
In large part.
But I think you've just said two contradictory things. One is that, you know, this created an opportunity for price discovery, right? You allow a company to fail, and then you just see what its assets are worth because the market settles on a price. And then you just said that the mark-to-market was a terrible system of accounting because the current market price is zero, when in fact we know they're not actually worth zero, right? So it suggests that in over short periods of time, the market can actually be quite irrational, and you don't actually get very constructive.
There's this weird thing, and I'm not necessarily accusing you of doing this, where people accuse those of us who actually prefer markets to government of thinking that the market is somehow perfect, that it's always rational, that it operates like a machine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like reading Harold Meyerson columns or, you know, in hell. No, that's not the point. I mean, the markets are in many ways irrational. They're sorting through all kinds of information, and they can have periods of time where people are freaked out and they're not buying and selling. That doesn't mean they don't work. It means that they're going through a rough patch, and they're going through a difficult part of, you know, of discovering those prices. Just because you can't discover that price on Tuesday afternoon doesn't mean that there isn't a price out there.
Right.
And being forced to value that at zero is silly.
No, agreed. But back to the previous point, I mean, if you go through prolonged periods, you know, weeks, where you can't, when there's no price discovery because there are no willing buyers, and there's no effective market, that can, you know, melt down your entire economy. I mean, that's,
what is melting down at that moment? I mean,
there are sort of cycles, vicious and virtuous, right? And suppose that we go through several weeks of, you know, ordinary businesses not being able to get credit to just conduct ordinary transactions, day-to-day transactions. Suddenly they have to start laying off people, right? They have to do less investment, buy fewer inventories. You know, the companies that rely on them as consumers also begin suffering. I mean, it's a chain reaction. You know, larger unemployment, lower consumption, lower investment, which, you know, further shrinks growth and reduces demand, or reduces the desire of lenders to lend, because people become even worse credit risk when the economy contracts. I mean, I think this stuff can reinforce itself pretty quickly and pretty violently.
But then we become, slaves to only accepting bubbles as they burst and never dealing with them when they deflate, and changing all risk. I mean, what causes a bubble in the first place is when people forget that there's risk.
Sure.
And that happened all throughout the economy, and it's particularly anything related to a mortgage.
Agreed.
Because Fannie and Freddie, there was an implicit and now an explicit guarantee that, you know, don't worry. And we're seeing this now in the Treasury and Federal Reserve, and definitely both major presidential candidates doing everything to make sure, even to the extent where McCain was offering to renegotiate anyone's mortgage, even if they're making their payments, everything's fine, but their house is worth less than when they first bought it. That's just madness.
You won't find me endorsing McCain's mortgage bailout plan. But the point that I was making is when a market's completely seized up and credit is just not being extended to anybody, even people who are exemplary credit risks, that's a really dangerous point for an economy to be in. And if it continues for too long, the damage to the real economy, not just the financial side of the economy, can be incredibly, incredibly steep.
I mean, it's the same, I hear the same thing, if there was a huge bank run, then we'd all be screwed. No doubt. Except there's not going to be a huge bank run, and there never really was. I mean, we, in the period of time when things locked up to a large degree, for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. that was also the period of time where the president of the freaking United States of America was standing up and saying, if you don't pass this bill right now, mm-hmm. we could basically have the next Great Depression. Mm-hmm. There was a level of fear-mongering, of just irresponsible pants-wetting mm-hmm. On the part of every single major economic official and public official in this country. I think it might actually sow a little bit of panic in the market here. What do you think? If you tell everybody that the sky is going to fall on their head and break their neck unless something happens right now, it might actually exacerbate the problem rather than help it. And now, we will have, some artificial liquidity thrown in. Maybe there has to be a correction of loose credit. And part of that means that people who before were able to get a loan won't be able to get a loan. That happens. That just happens sometimes.
I agree. We don't disagree about this. I believe that credit contraction is often a healthy thing. What I disagree as being healthy, I mean, you're not saying it's healthy, but I think it can't be allowed to happen, is a total seizing up of credit markets, which just collapses economies.
I've not been persuaded that that was on the verge of happening and that was going to be something to happen. I mean, ultimately, there is a global market in finance, and if some guy is running a super, efficient shop in Wichita, Kansas, selling, Dennis Miller dolls or something like that, that shop is going to find money from somebody if they know that he's going to pay back his loans. I mean, it's not going to be zero forever. There's just no way. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, no one's arguing to be zero forever, but if it's zero for weeks and months at a time, you get the Great Depression, basically. I don't think we're going to resolve this today, but maybe we should segue to this Death of Libertarianism article that Jacob Weisberg wrote that is thematically related to what we're talking about here. I sort of read what you wrote about it and a lot of the response in libertarian circles. But why don't you maybe briefly describe the article and then describe share your thoughts on maybe the logical flaws that he made?
Yeah, I mean, Jake Weisberg, editor of Slate, wrote in both Slate and in Newsweek a thing, and you've seen variations on this by a lot of different writers in the national press, that the financial crisis is the ultimate indictment of, either neoliberalism or the Washington consensus, and in his case, he was very explicit about it, is the death of libertarians, that libertarians caused this financial crisis, that they have, at long last have wreaked, too much damage, and they should basically be shunned from all polite society, and, there's no bailout that's going to help them now. It was bizarre, to be charitable about it. I mean, one salient point is that George W. Bush, the president of the last 8 years, as far as I can tell, has increased regulatory spending by 65% in real terms, not just nominal terms, during the course of his presidency. If he's the deregulation president, then I am, I don't know, I am the fill in the blank. Then I'm a Frankenstein monster, basically. It doesn't make sense. Libertarians were deliberately shunned out of the GOP big tent, basically starting in the 2000 election, which this is part of my book, actually, when McCain ran against Bush, McCain was the national greatness conservative, Bush was the compassionate conservatives. Both of those ideologies were understood as explicit rejections of what was seen as sort of the harsh libertarianism of the 94 Republican Congress, sort of the Gingrich Revolution types. And you know, McCain said, you know, my opponent, to his credit, rejected the go-it-alone libertarianism and saw government as a force for good. George W. Bush has been a big government conservative all along. So to look at his economic policies and say, aha, the libertarians are running everything, I think is just not very accurate. Also, in both Weisberg's column and in most discussions of this, ours today, somewhat accepted, you just hear, oh, deregulation caused it. And then when I ask the question, which deregulation caused it exactly, then you tend to get a lot of blank stares. You know, a lot of people say, well, it was the Glass-Steagall Act or the amendment to it in 1999. It's not very convincing that reducing the Chinese wall between insurance companies, commercial banks, and investment banks had much to do with this crisis in any meaningful sense. It certainly allowed for the investment banks to get gobbled up by the commercial banks once they started to fail, which is something that would not have been legal had that act not been passed. Weisberg doesn't want to get into all that. He would rather talk about the fact that libertarians allegedly are all people who had their ideologies seared into their minds when they read Ayn Rand sitting in their basements when they were 14 years old. And it's just kind of it's interesting. I mean, he's had a chip on his shoulder about libertarians for 12 or 13 years. He wrote a book in the 90s called In Defense of Big Government, which was timed perfectly almost to coincide with Bill Clinton declaring the era of big government was over, and he made the same sort of weird charge about you know, these 14-year-old Ayn Rand, I'm sorry, geeks. I mean, it's curious on a lot of levels, but one of which is that it's sort of it doesn't allow for the type of libertarians who say, you know, by and large work for Reason magazine. I mean, I've never read an Ayn Rand novel in my life. I probably won't unless there's a nice short one that I can tuck into. I just come about it as sort of as a pragmatic question of, you know, all else being equal, I'd rather have markets work rather than, you know, government, especially on stuff like, you know, setting industrial policy and these kind of things, which is not to say that there can't be any regulation. On the contrary, we have in this magazine talked about the need for more regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and have for years. Simply putting them to the kind of tests and regulation that the private market has, or the non-GSE market has, would have been a great help in this. They were allowed to trade in all these derivatives and have capital ratios that were just a lot different than other banks that were selling mortgages. So it's an interesting time, I think, to psychoanalyze just a half a second. That part of it is, you know, the sort of there's a resurgence of kind of Keynesian liberalism right now, and for good reason. They're going to win the elections and they're going to do a victory lap. And part of that, they want to be able to blame all of this on the ideology that they don't like. In order to do that, you need to not look too closely on what the ideology has been in actual governance over the last 8 years. And, you know, at Reason, we've been punching the hell out of Bush since basically he, you know, his inauguration day, and have been slamming him as a big government conservative literally from day one. And so to try to blame it all on people like us, I think smacks of almost a lack of confidence, because, you know, I don't think that the American public, by and large, is ready for a new Keynesian revolution. I could be wrong about that, but just in the discussions that I have about the bailout, for example, on talk radio and on, like, Wisconsin public radio, I get nothing except hostility to the idea from everybody. It's really amazing. And so the kinds of people who sort of are rubbing their hands together, I think, are flirting with overstretch and kind of declaring the death of an ideology a little bit prematurely. What did you think?
Wow, that's a mouthful. I guess I'd make a couple points. One, I think you were right, and a lot of the critics of the article were right, in that using the recent financial crisis to declare the death of libertarianism was a couple of leaps that weren't supported, you know, by kind of logical steps in the article. If for no other reason than we, you know, as a lot of people point out, we don't live in the sort of in the world of the libertarian ideal. You know, what we had in place was a highly non-libertarian system, and so you can't take a crisis in a highly non-libertarian system and, you know, interpret it as a rejection of libertarianism. I thought that was problematic. I guess what I would say, and I think he would have been on much more solid ground had he been more modest in his ambition in that piece, is saying, look, we live in this non-libertarian system. There are a lot of regulations. We don't live in a perfectly free market system. You know, given that we live in that sort of system, nudging it too many ticks in the sort of libertarian direction, in the sort of deregulatory direction, can have consequences which are potentially, you know, disastrous. And I guess that would bring me to my second point, which is, you know, you cited a statistic about a rise in regulatory spending. You know, I guess I don't know what that really means in the abstract. I mean, I'm not denying that that's true, that we spend more money on regulatory agencies and regulatory enforcement, but it has to sort of be measured relative to something, you know, relative to the proliferation of, say, new financial products. You know, I mean, we could be increasing our regulatory spending at 10%, and all sorts of new financial instruments are coming online at a much faster rate and are being traded at a much faster rate and still basically losing ground relative to the complexity of the system. So,
And just to interject, my regulatory thing, that was for all regulations. It's not Wall Street specific.
Sure. Okay.
And I think that there is a, you know, the best argument that I've heard about you know, the relationship between regulation and the crisis has been that the credit default swaps weren't, there was no clearinghouse for them.
Right.
We couldn't measure them. And that is the one sort of like regulatory argument that to me has resonance. But I mean, this is after asking everybody for specifics. Tell me where we went wrong.
Well,
tell me how I screwed up your life.
So I want to get into some specifics. Yeah. So I mean, you know, I David Brooks wrote a column a couple of weeks ago that made a version of your argument. And one of the arguments was banking is one of the most heavily regulated sectors of the economy. So the idea that there wasn't enough regulation is sort of preposterous. And I think that's just much too crude an argument. For one thing, so much more of credit creation happens outside of the formal banking sector now. You know, hedge funds and, you know, insurance companies like AIG selling credit default swaps and, you know, and investment banks. I mean, these guys aren't formally regulated by the banking regulators. If you look at, say, the Federal Reserve, they only regulate banks, commercial banks, not investment banks, not hedge funds, not insurance companies. So that's what we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
So even if you could argue that the banking sector is the most heavily regulated sector of the economy, that doesn't really, you know, begin to deal with a majority of what we've been talking about. So now on to specifics. Yeah, I think credit default swaps were really problematic. Derivatives generally, I mean, there are so many sort of bilateral derivatives deal that we don't, you know, when a company like Lehman melts down, we don't even have a record of who the trades were with. So we have to start going searching through the records, in the wreckage, trying to put it all back together. The other thing I would say is just leverage. You know, I mean, it's a common, you know, it's not just doing some derivatives trades, is that you can be leveraged, you know, 50 or 100 times, you know, making some of these bets, which is, you know, which is great when you're making money, but when the bet goes bad, suddenly you've got a big gaping hole in your balance sheet and it threatens the solvency of your hedge fund or your investment bank. So leverage itself is dangerous, you know, can be pretty dangerous when you're dealing with a lot of, you know, innovative, complex financial products that people don't even really understand the risk characteristics of. And I think that has to be looked into, too. So, I mean,
there are leverage ratios. I mean, there are in many different...
I mean, hedge funds don't have to, you know, hedge funds can basically leverage as much as you know, someone's willing to give them on a bet.
As far as I understand, and I hope I'm not speaking out of term, but if a hedge fund belongs to a financial institution like an AIG or a commercial bank or investment bank, it's more difficult. I think the AIG one is that they were based in London, but if they'd been based in New York, that would have been regulated.
I mean, but there are tons of hedge funds that aren't associated with large commercial institutions. I mean, that's...
Right, and when they go down, it's not going to imperil the economy. I see what you're saying, there are leverage ratios. I think that there's an argument that you can have, higher capital ratio requirements different things, selectively in times of trouble, lower ones. I mean, part of the part of the kind of credit freeze we were talking about before was that bad combination of mark-to-market meant that you had to put X number of your assets valued inaccurately at zero,
right.
And then you had to satisfy your capital ratios based on that, and it was kind of a twofer. I don't think AIG was really a bad firm. I think they had one really, really lousy pile of crap in London, and I think that crisis could have easily been averted in retrospect,
let's take that. I mean, AIG got in trouble selling a lot of these credit default swaps, which are basically insurance for bonds, right?
Yeah.
And the problem with AIG is they didn't have to have reserves that were anywhere near large enough to support losses, right? So that meant that if they had to pay up on these insurance policies that they were selling to bondholders, they didn't have any reserves that they could tap to do that. I mean, the number of outstanding policies, if you will, far, far, far exceeded the reserves that they had. So it seems to me that a sensible regulation would be, okay, people can sell this insurance for bonds, but they have to reserve at a reasonable rate. They have to set enough money aside so that if these things come due, if they have to pay up on their policy, they'll have enough money to do that, and it won't wipe out what was otherwise a pretty profitable company. So that seems to me a reasonable regulation. And again, just a crude argument about this being a heavily regulated sector of the economy doesn't quite match up with the details of what happened.
Well, I think actually when you talk about it on the specific level, it ends up just being a more useful exercise all around.
Because
talk about those specific regulations, those are the ones that make sense.
Yeah.
Have a clearinghouse for credit default swaps. Now, there's one caveat with that, is that a lot of derivatives arise because sort of as a reaction to existing regulations that require clearinghouses and other kind of things. That's always going to happen, and it's not always negative. It can become negative when it gets over-leveraged like crazy and no one's paying any attention to it. But that's also a source of great, financial innovation. And it's one of the reasons why we were able to, achieve what many people saw as a social good of bumping up home ownership from 62% to 70%. Right. We did put a lot of capital in this economy. If you bought a house in 1997 and sold it in 2006, you're really not complaining about what's going on over this period of time. So, I mean, it's really easy to look at, the bad side of a bubble and declare all of that stuff bad. I lived through that during the dot-com thing, and maybe you did too, but which, by the way, was the greatest collapse and bubble bursting ever, because no one even thought for a second about bailing anybody out, because it just basically affected, schmucks like us.
There was a bailout in one respect, which is the monetary system was flooded with cash.
That's true. That's a good point in that, definitely, it transferred the bubble mentality from, NASDAQ to the housing market.
This is, I think, a point that we will probably agree on. I mean, I think the problem with sort of deregulatory impulses or failure to regulate in our system is this. We live in a system that has a lot of financial market innovation. There are constantly new, complex products coming online, and they come online very, very quickly, and people can place bets on them, highly, highly leveraged bets. So that's happening on one side. On the other side, we're sort of unwilling to have recessions in this country. We're unwilling to sort of accept losses. So anytime that there is, kind of a whiff of a recession, the Fed tends to flood the economy with liquidity. Well, all that money ends up somewhere, and it ends up being placed, it often ends up as bets placed on these very sophisticated new financial products. So
especially the ones that are, in some sense, guaranteed by the government because they're tied to stuff like mortgages,
right,
which are over-guaranteed by the government. And think about what they've done in the last like couple of months. Every day there's some new, well, the Fed is going to guarantee another $500 billion worth of CDs. The amount of guarantees in the economy now from the federal government, I mean, it must have quintupled in the last couple of months.
Certainly.
And so when you're there and you know that this stuff is guaranteed, what are you going to do? You're going to shop around to whoever is offering you the highest rate because you know regardless you're going to be able to get your money at the end. And that's going to – so that's the moral hazard ultimately that I'm even more worried about on some level. When you don't allow anyone to fail from their risk and when you react to a crisis by spreading even more guarantees out, it is by definition – going to throw more money in stuff that can drive rates higher. So that's just going to be a new round of kind of leveraged products tied to stuff that is being given guarantees. So I see that whole aspect creating another bubble in another area, you know, in the very near future or even presently as we're speaking. And that's ultimately worrying. I mean, it's bizarre to me. I lived in Eastern Europe in the 1990s. And lived through a couple of banking crises there in Hungary and in the Czech Republic. And it's just – it's amazing the amount of tolerance that those societies had then for short-term pain, knowing that we're going in the right direction, you know. And America has, like, less tolerance for anything resembling economic pain than maybe any other country. And maybe it's more of the elite class than it is the actual individuals involved, actual citizens. So I have some hope that there's that we have some allies out there in the great unwashed public. But on the official class, you have Henry Paulson saying the decline in housing prices is a market failure. That to me is like more chilling than almost anything else happening right now. We have gotten to a position in this country where we cannot tolerate declining housing prices. That, to me, is just madness.
Right. Well, you know, I
at least until I buy a house.
I guess I would say, as a general rule, I mean, and again, I don't think we're too far apart on this. I think given that, you know, certainly in the kind of general management of the business cycle, we've gotten to the point politically where we won't tolerate a recession of any length or depth, meaning that the Fed has to offset, you know, or respond to it by dramatically lowering interest rates and flooding the market with money. Given that that's the sort of political reality, it seems, and given that we have on the other end of the spectrum this incredible proliferation of complicated new financial products that people can use that new liquidity to place bets on, highly leveraged bets on, it seems to me it's very dangerous to then move in a direction of not regulating or regulating less and not keeping up. Keeping the regulation up with the proliferation of new products. I mean, obviously, it's in some respects, it's impossible, right? I mean, it's like steroids and trying to keep steroids out of Olympic sports. I mean, the abusers are always going to be ahead of the regulatory authorities. That said, I think you still have to try because, again, given the intolerance for recessions and the reflex to just pump cash into the system, that seems like it's not going to change anytime soon, which means that you have to, on the regulatory end, do something to make sure that people aren't taking crazy leverage bets with financial instruments they don't understand. That's the politically possible way to deal with it.
Well, people will take less bets if they have seen failure. And that's the rule.
If risk is never punished,
then people will take those bets. And
I think a central theme of our discussion is that there isn't an appetite to punish people. Like politically, it just doesn't exist, right? The one data point we have was Lehman, which, you know, I argued, and you seem somewhat sympathetic to this point, that no one's ever going to want to repeat that, right? Because, you know, there's hell to pay for any regulator.
We might, and we should probably close on this because we're going long.
Sure.
But we might get to a point where we don't have a choice. Recessions are intolerable, but we're going to have one. And at some point, we're going to run out of money to guarantee anything. We're going to run out of the ability to broker some, you know, quote-unquote rescue of whatever financial institution is getting the vapors today. And ultimately, that to me is the real danger, not a short-term seize up of credit markets in the wake of a single investment bank failure.
Right. I mean, I guess where we differ is I would say, I mean, we both think that there could be another bubble to come out of this, because of our response to the current crisis. My point would just be step in very soon and prevent people from taking these risky high leverage bets so that we don't get to the bubble stage. And your response is, kind of purge, let people just make the mistakes, let the institutions collapse, let people go under, and then they'll learn and we won't have the problem again.
I think that when you expand the amount of guarantees that we are expanding right now on the federal level, then you are writing into the system even more appetite for risk, and that is the problem. You can create a clearinghouse for credit default swaps and whatever the next iteration is of things like that. I'm not going to scream until I'm blue in the face about that. What I will scream about is when, Henry Paulson sits 9 banks in a room, half of them don't want to be nationalized or partially nationalized, and he forces that upon them. I think that is going in the wrong direction of what needs to happen in this country and just the normal functioning of any kind of market, that's very troubling. And just the spreading of all guarantees against risk, that is much, much more likely to create the next bubble, in my estimation, than the lack of recognition that this new hedge fund derivative instrument might be getting large enough that we need to create a new clearinghouse. I mean, I think that we really exaggerate the centrality of that, not of credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities, which were huge, but it's the guarantee side. It's the elimination of risk that is going to create all the risk that's coming down the pipe. And the fact that, with the government now running banks, they're going to do a worse job of it than other people. And I think it's a direct result of policies that are being contemplated now and that will definitely be enacted in the next year or two or three or four. We might start to see New York losing its international luster as the international home of financial markets. And that would have impacts on this country that I don't think that we really have grappled with. But with that, let's grapple to a close, Noah Schreiber.
Well, I enjoyed it. I don't think we resolved every issue relating to the financial crisis here.
That's why we work for different magazines.
Yeah, I think we resolved a good 90% of it, though, so we're on the right track.
That's great. Thank you very much, and hope to do this again soon. Where are you going to be on election night?
I think I'll be on my couch watching, a nice medley of networks range across the ideological spectrum.
Well, since the last time I took in an election in D.C. Was 2000, where I was covering the Ralph Nader campaign, and then took a walk around the White House at 3 in the morning and fell in with a bunch of young Republicans, and then walked to my hotel room at 4:30 in the morning and then got mugged. I can only hope that my election night will be anywhere near as eventful.
Well, hear, hear.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much,
right.
And thank you, Internet, and for Blogging Heads TV. I am Matt Welch, and good night.
Good night.